This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
Have you ever covered a carpet stain with a rug? Ignored a leaky faucet? Pretended your half-painted living room is supposed to look like that? Well, you're not alone. We've all got unfinished home projects. But there's an easier way. When you download Thumbtack, it's easier to care for your home from top to bottom. Pull out your phone, and in just a few steps, you can search, chat, and book highly rated pros right in your neighborhood. Plus, you'll know what to tackle next, because Thumbtack is the app that shows you what to do, who to hire, and when. So say goodbye to all those unfinished home projects, and say hello to caring for your home the easier way. Download Thumbtack and start a project today.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1...
But who's counting, right?
His name is Major.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen,
please welcome Major Garrett
from the nation's capital.
Major, fantastic.
It's the Takeout.
This is a major achievement.
With CBS News Chief Washington Correspondent.
Major Garrett.
Yes, CBS.
Yes, hi.
Major Garrett.
Major, that's nonsense, and you should know better.
Is Major out of the doghouse?
The answer is yes.
Welcome to the very best part of my broadcast week. This is Major Garrett. The show is The Takeout. Our guest, Patrick McHenry. He is the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee. Mr. Chairman, it's great to see you.
Great to be with you. Thanks, Major.
We're at Ted's Bulletin, one of our favorite restaurants near Capitol Hill, so that happy sound you hear around us will be an, I hope, energetic part of the background noise of the show. A big issue, Mr. Chairman. We're recording this on January 19th. The Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has just informed the Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, that the United States has met and reached its statutory debt limit. Will the U.S. default in the calendar year 2023?
No.
And how can you be so sure?
These deadlines have been often reached, and we've always negotiated our way through this thing. The opening stance here from any administration is we're not negotiating, and every administration negotiates. And it's in connection with both a spending level agreement between the House, the Senate, and the White House, and a release of the debt ceiling for a period of time. So we have a statutory requirement on the debt ceiling, and I think we have to make sure that we meet that expectation of upping the debt ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
Debt ceiling is about previous decisions
yes.
made. It is the equivalent as a parent of finding out your child has gotten a credit card at college.
Mm-hmm.
And you get the first statement back and you see that it's pizza and booze. Okay, you may not be happy about the decision about spending that money and putting the debt on the credit card. But you have to make a decision on whether or not to ruin your child's credit rating to make a point to them or deal with the issue, right? Take care of the debt piece and deal with the behavior piece separately.
Separately.
So those are two separate functions.
Right.
So I think it's important that we understand those as two separate functions. However, when we get into a negotiation of this sort, you have a lot of interest from fiscal conservatives for us to address in a sincere and real way the fiscal house. And that is the reason why it's always raised in connection with our debt and deficit. But it really deals with current year spending
right.
and the question of whether or not we're dealing with longer term mandatory spending that brings structural reforms.
On this day, January 19th, the Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, has said he wants to engage the White House and Senate Democrats in negotiations over spending cuts linked to increasing the debt ceiling. In December, you were quoted, and I want to read this directly to you, "I'm going to advocate for a separation of those two issues. so that we can have a proper debate. Is that still your position?
That's still my position. That doesn't mean it's a winning position, and it doesn't mean that that holds sway over the majority of Republicans in the House. It clearly does not. I respect that. Now, how do we address this? Well, first, I want my colleagues to understand what the Treasury's market is and what it's not. This is global money. It goes right back to the U.S. having the reserve currency status for the globe. It's not simply the power of our dollar. It's also treasuries that act as dollars globally, which enhance trade with the United States and connectivity.
You've described treasuries as, quote, the lifeblood of U.S. capital markets.
And I think that's probably an understatement. This is...
And members on your side should understand that.
This is like air and water for international commerce. It's about every financial institution around the globe and something they have on their balance sheet that they consider riskless. Mm-hmm. Once we make that a non-riskless asset, it changes the whole economics globally and global growth. And so it does have big impacts. So while I'm going to continue to advocate for what I think are wise decisions on how we separate the two issues, I think they are fundamentally linked, especially in a year like we're experiencing right now. And I think that's why it's so important to make clear to the administration that cooler heads need to prevail and that we need to address fiscal solvency for the long term, and we need to do it now and get on with that conversation.
What would be for you, Mr. Chairman, a demonstration of cooler heads prevailing at the White House? What would you need to hear or see?
Well, I think Senator Manchin, being the first Democrat to say, well, actually, we should address the fiscal solvency of Medicare.
He currently does not work at the White House.
That's true.
He may have aspirations, but he doesn't now. What do you need to see from the White House?
That, yes, they will engage, and they're willing to engage on a fiscal panel to address Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security solvency that are structural reforms necessary to keep them solvent for the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years. I think that would be a hopeful sign that we can make some progress and not have brinksmanship.
So far, the White House position has been we are not going to negotiate, and to not only say that, but to add adjectives about with whom the negotiators might be.
Well, that's fine.
And terrorists, financial terrorists, financial wrecking crew. They want to destroy the U.S. solvency in order to either make or try to achieve a policy or political point. That's the rhetoric that has accompanied this. It's the rhetoric that's accompanied these standoffs in the past. Do you expect that rhetoric to yield?
No. I mean, look, they can say whatever harsh words they want about folks that want to address fiscal solvency. I got it. It's a political debate. I'm telling you my position of separating these two is not the prevailing view among House Republicans. I'm trying to advocate a ground here so we can get through the situation. I'm trying to address things as they are, not as I wish them to be. Mm-hmm. And so the White House can hope their way through and hope that it turns out for them like it did for Obama. And by the way, that's most of their playbook. I got it. Just trying to be Obama and hope to live for another day. But in this situation, it's not going to work that way.
It's different.
And it's a very different situation than when we're sitting in 11
and 12. The perception I have, Mr. Chairman, is it's different because the number of House Republicans who are entrenched on this issue is larger than it was in the Obama confrontations. And in the aftermath of the protracted, and I don't need to tell you how protracted it was, battle for Kevin McCarthy to achieve the speakership, representations were made to those hardliners. What were they?
Well, they said, we want to address our fiscal house. And that means we have to have an aggressive stance when it comes to the budget we pass through the House of Representatives, the spending levels we have for current year appropriations bills, and then a desire to have structural reforms for the long term to put us on a solvent path. The fact is, Republicans are returning to power with a federal government that is a third larger than when we left power 4 years ago in the House of Representatives. It is significantly larger than it was pre-COVID. So there's a firm desire among conservatives to address the fiscal house. What I'm trying to do is arbitrate a deal between an unwilling White House an emboldened left that think that debt and deficits don't matter, and fiscal conservatives that believe the fundamentals of our economy revolve around our fiscal stability long-term, our growth prospects, our tax rates, and our social safety net all require us to address these spending levels. So I'm trying to bring people together, and they're all saying very harsh things that make it almost unimaginable that you could come to terms. But we have to come to terms, and I don't care how harsh the rhetoric is, we have to fix the problem for the state of the economy and for the state of the global economy.
And by fixing the problem, so my audience understands, that means statutorily raising the debt limit. This
Correct.
Has to be done.
Yes. It's a necessary part of governing. And what I'm saying is, in order for us to unhitch that, you then have to have a process to address the larger fiscal house questions.
But you don't know what that looks like yet, do you, Mr. Chairman?
We don't know what the art of the possible is on this date. But we have time. We have a few months. We've got roughly 6 months is best guess, perhaps seven, to address those things.
Let me stop you right there, Mr. Chairman. 6 or 7 months to resolve this, maybe less. I'm Major Garrett. Patrick McHenry is our special guest. Back in a moment.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
From CBS News, this is The Takeout with Major Garrett.
Welcome back to The Takeout. Ted's Bulletin is our host restaurant. They specialize in homemade Pop-Tarts. That will be the menu choice of the day. Pop-Tarts and coffee.
Buttering me up.
Exactly.
So I'll actually
sugar
dish,
and caffeine
right?
makes the world go round, at least from my perspective. Patrick McHenry is our guest. He is the chairman of the Financial Services Committee on the House side. Mr. Chairman, continuing our conversation, Bloomberg wrote this week that you are the key Republican to watch in these entire negotiations. Do you believe that's true?
No.
Who is the key Republican to watch?
Kevin McCarthy.
You have a very close relationship, working and political, with the Speaker, do you not?
I do.
You were instrumental in him ultimately obtaining the speakership, were you not?
There are a lot of us that were helpful to him in the vital week that was 15 votes for the speakership.
Laid out for all the world to see.
That's right. And as I said then, the goal usually in politics and in life is to suffer your indignities in private, not in public. But we did it full scale in public as House Republicans. So, look, I have confidence in the Speaker. I have confidence in his leadership capacity and ability to get the best of every political situation he can. But in this situation for the debt ceiling, it's a complex set of trade-offs. And there'll be a lot of folks that are willing to help, both in the House and the Senate. But we need a White House to engage.
You talked a moment ago, Mr. Chairman, about the art of the possible. I'm a big believer in the art of the possible. I've watched it play out, and I've watched it come to frustrating standoffs. Mm-hmm. You said a moment ago that the current prevailing attitude within the House Republican Conference is to entrench on this issue. Do you believe there's a possibility, to use your words, of persuading your House Republican colleagues differently? Or do you think they're going to stay where they are, and therefore the White House has to move?
Well, I think both need to happen.
You need to soften them up a little bit, and the White House needs to soften its edges a bit.
And so what we're talking about, you know, there are a number of policy proposals to address our fiscal house that are at play here. Some are commissions to review, for instance, Medicare or Medicaid and the solvency issues connected there. Others have reviewed Social Security, like we did with the Greenspan Commission in the early 80s, that changed Social Security structurally.
So an off-ramp might be the creation of a presidentially organized, congressionally mandated commission on these issues?
Well, a joint congressional executive branch commission. There have been a number that have been kicked around over the years. And so something like that could be an off-ramp, and that would be something that I would advocate for. And if we can get if we could get a commission like that, that has the potential to unlock a number of keys to this legislative year. First with the debt ceiling, and then second with government funding measures. Mm-hmm. So very important national defense priorities, as well as domestic priorities we have to fund for the fall.
Mr. Chairman, I don't need to tell you that I can hear the voices, though I'm never allowed in on the House Republican conference meetings, I can hear the voices now saying, oh, for God's sake, how many commissions have we had on this? Erskine Bowles and Alan Simpson, and I can name others. I'll just leave it at that. And they've all gone nowhere. Why would we believe in a commission now? Why would we accept that as a negotiating victory when they haven't been in the past? I think I would be fairly representative of the voices you might hear in a private House Republican conference on this question, would I not?
Sure. And this is about a menu of options. It's not about the greatest genius idea ever to come to man. And so what I'm talking about is the art of the possible. And when you have a menu, as we do, of options, it is not an infinite array of choices. And you
a
have
limited
to pick.
Array. It really is a limited array.
So, and we're dealing with a stubborn administration and a progressive left that is very different from where they were 10 years ago. There's a belief among prominent Democrats that our debt and deficit do not have negative economic impacts, but are in fact an enhancement to our growth capacity. And that type of economic thinking was laughed out of economic debates for generations, and now is over a period of a decade is held great sway among Democrats. So the left is in a different spot than we were a decade ago, but
and
also
the right
the
is
right.
in a different spot.
Correct,
and that's why there's genuine anxiety. I don't need to tell you this, Mr. Chairman, on Wall Street, among sovereign wealth funds, and individuals who buy treasuries, I sense a much higher degree of anxiety about this being resolved than the last time I went through this.
Yes.
The last time I went through this, it seemed to most observers an unseemly but necessary bit of political theatrics. Unseemly is still a word they would use, but they are fearful that this will not be theatrical. This will be practical and potentially, for a period of time, a measurable period of time, ruinous.
And that's the reason why I have my firm position on where I think we should be. And what I'm saying is my position is not the dominant position here. I think we should resolve this and have our fiscal conversation separate and distinct from it. But we're not in that situation.
Not yet.
And so we can come to terms with that, or the White House can risk enormous peril. I don't think it's a good situation when you have a stubborn White House not willing to have any conversations whatsoever. I think that is economically stupid. So I think we have to enable cooler heads to prevail, and that's where I'm going to remain. Mm-hmm. I'm going to try to remain in the center here so that we can actually have a reasonable thing come together.
It sounds like a weedy question, but it's really not. It's a very practical question. Are you in favor of a numeric increase in the debt ceiling or a time horizon?
I am agnostic. I've supported both. I've actually supported both.
From the Treasury Department's perspective, they would like a date because a dollar amount is less predictable.
Correct, especially in an interest rate environment, inflationary environment like we currently are in, where economic growth forecasts and income forecasts have been wildly off the mark. I completely understand that. I've supported both policies in the past. I've voted for both policies in the past. I am for what we can get done, and that
what
is
can pass.
Yeah,
right.
And look. I spent time in House Republican leadership, mm-hmm. and I've now spent time running a committee. It was my intention to go back and run committee and focus on policy and policy initiatives that I could get enacted into law. That's been my focus, not to get dragged into these larger political debates that leadership needs to go make decisions on. Mm-hmm. That was my intention and my focus in going back to run the House Financial Services Committee.
Right.
But you get pulled back in when matters of state call. And this, I think, is an important matter of state.
And if the White House were to say, we can have a discussion about future entitlement spending, would that by itself be enough?
I think that would be a significant give in a significant way from a White House that has been stubborn to admit even the basic of economic facts.
Can you imagine a scenario, though, Mr. Chairman, where the White House, who has said that we are not budging on Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid because we helped create them in the first place, we the Democratic Party, and therefore we're not going to start there. Can you imagine a political position they would take that would move so far away from that rhetoric?
So we have insolvency dates for these large entitlement programs. There are 2028 and 2032.
2028 for?
For Medicare, right. If I'm remembering this correctly, and 2032 for Social Security benefits. So these are dates that are actions of law, and if they want to preside over massive cuts through inaction, that is their prerogative. And they can answer the political questions there. When we have insolvency of these institutions, these vital economic safety nets for the American people, I think we have a moral obligation to go address them to save them for the next generation. And so they can be a part of addressing and saving them, and they can do so in a bipartisan way. But without any kind of bipartisanship here, we're going to be at an impasse for the debt ceiling, and we're going to be in an impasse for spending bills for the next 2 years. And then we're going to have to wait for the next presidential election to figure out what we're going to do on national defense, domestic spending, and then we're going to have to suffer the economic consequences of inaction on the debt ceiling. I don't think that's a smart way for presidential leadership to express itself.
That is
nor
the voice.
Do I think it's in the economic interest of the American people.
The voice of Patrick McHenry, the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee. I'm Major Garrett, back for segment three of The Takeout in just a minute.
At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than just a car or a house. It's the four wheels that get you where you're going and the four walls that welcome you home. When you combine auto and home insurance with Amica, we'll help protect it all. And the more you cover, the more you can save. Amica. Empathy is our best policy.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
From CBS News, this is The Takeout with Major Garrett.
Welcome back to The Takeout. Ted's Bulletin, our host restaurant. What you see arrayed in front of us, Ted Tarts. Not that other thing I said earlier, Ted Tarts.
Let's see what these things are like.
And
here.
The chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, Patrick McHenry, is going to dig in, as am I. Coffee and sugar makes the world go round. Changing topics, Mr. Chairman. FTX is a massive cryptocurrency failure with criminal implications. There are enormous questions raised about the viability of cryptocurrency. What does FTX tell us about that viability?
That you have sociopaths and fraudsters attracted to new technology. Always is the case. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. That's always the case. The Pop-Tart, the TED Tarts are fantastic. new technology always invites in fraudsters and sociopaths. And this is certainly a new technology. The reason why they're able to take advantage in this marketplace is our failure to actually provide clear rules of the road and a clear set of regulation that protects consumers and enables innovation. So the largest American-affiliated exchange was domiciled in the Bahamas. You don't think of the Bahamas as the same sort of marker as Hong Kong or London or New York,
right?
So you question, why in the hell were they there in the first place? Mm-hmm. Well, it can't be because of a high regulation or consumer protection regime. So so we have to have clarity around our regulation. We have to have clarity for two reasons, that consumer protection piece and also the innovation piece. There is enormous amount of there's an enormous amount of economic potential that could be unleashed through this new technology. When you take out third-party intermediaries in an exchange, it can reduce the cost of those exchanges and can enable greater economic activity. Now, that's the potential. Along the road here, we've had enormous loss of people's assets, and consumers have been harmed. We have enormous number of fraudsters in this regime that need to be wrung out, and we have to bring greater amount of transparency to this whole process. So there's a lot that has to happen, but clear rules of the road here in the United States can unlock this economic potential.
Patrick McHenry is our guest, chairman of the Financial Services Committee on the House side. You know, Mr. Chairman, that one of the reasons all the things you just said didn't happen was because the crypto industry was sloshing this town with campaign contributions on both sides of the aisle to create bumpers or ways to hedge against exactly what you just described. Strict regulatory rules and methods by which they had to operate.
Well,
that's a failure of the system on two levels, it seems to me.
Yeah, they were coming here seeking inaction.
Right. And making campaign contributions in order to guarantee inaction.
And we had regulators that are asleep at the switch. So we have existing regulators at the CFTC and the SEC that it didn't apply existing rules around how you hold assets and how you protect consumers' value. They didn't apply the basics of those rules to these entities. Had they done that, American investors would be less bad off than they currently are. So you had regulators asleep at the switch, and that had nothing to do with campaign fundraising at all. Had everything to do with their malfeasance. And I lay the blame at Gary Gensler, the SEC, for their inaction, the Securities and Exchange Commission. And I see bipartisan challenges on Capitol Hill for us to legislate and provide clear rules of the road here. But it's my goal to go fix that problem through clarity under law. And that doesn't mean it's going to be perfectly pleasing to any one group, but it's going to be the necessary clarity so we can actually have an asset that could be freely traded, and we can then unlock the potential, the economic potential of this new product.
When will the industry and American investors writ large see that legislation from the House Financial Services Committee? Well, when they should expect that?
We started with bipartisan hearings overseeing FTX. Mm-hmm. First started under Chairwoman Waters in December, the Financial Services Committee, and I will take that over with our first hearing in the month of February, once our committee's up and running. And we're going to continue this theme of what happened with FTX, how we address it. Then we'll see legislation come out of the committee by summer.
By summer. Is Sam Bankman-Fried the only sociopath in this space?
No.
What is he?
He is a pretender to the technology, and he's a pretender to all the things that made him laudable in the media. Where he littered a bunch of the media infrastructure through nonprofit entities in order to get favorable coverage of himself. And he pretended to many different things, whether it's ESG ethos, whether it was liberalism or progressivism. It was, or the technology itself, that he was a technologist. He was running a multifaceted crypto exchange using QuickBooks, a small business software that all of us can access to run our small businesses. No large business runs off this. It's not designed to do that. And that's what he was a pretender to the technology. And so in every facet of the word, he represents what is absolute worst about the world of crypto and about the world of business. It was made off.
He beguiled smart people. How did he do that? He beguiled lots of smart people.
Oh, absolutely, and smart money. He stole a lot of smart money and average retail investors as well. It was a world-class sociopath doing big things. I mean, there'll be stories written and movies written about his capacity that was quite special and quite different than folks that have come to town during my time.
And when you see him give interviews where he expresses confusion about what happened and suggests that he didn't really understand how all this collapsed so rapidly, what do you say to yourself?
It's bull. But I shouldn't say that on a venerable news agency like CBS. He's proven himself to be a sociopath by his actions. He's proven himself to be untrustworthy by his actions. No word he utters should be believed. Period.
For those who are still trying to wrap their head around the methodology of cryptocurrency, how it's valued, how it's produced, how it should be traded, what would you tell them?
At the very beginning of all new technologies, there's a great question of utility. Both, first with internal combustion engine, the automobile, petrochemicals, oil, trains. All at the very inception of these things that are useful entities.
Electricity.
Right. What are you going to do with these things? What good will it produce?
And what are the risks attached?
Yes. And so we have those same questions at the beginning of the internet. What are people going to do with it? Mm-hmm. What is the economic potential here? We had award-winning economists that questioned the economic utility of the internet at the beginning of the internet. And the internet has unlocked so much economic potential in ways that we couldn't have conceived of. People exchanging products that don't know each other, right. Homemade products or right. Otherwise, that commerce we couldn't have contemplated. Or using the internet to actually get a car service to go take you somewhere. Mm-hmm. We could have contemplated 30 years ago. So we're in a similar position with blockchain technology and cryptocurrencies that enable blockchain technology. We don't understand fully the potential that could be brought here. The first thing we think of is the world of payments, mm-hmm. Micropayments being unlocked, and economic potential around small dollar exchanges of value. But that's the first thing.
Right.
We don't know what's going to be built off this new set of protocols.
We're going to talk about blockchain and verification of payments in a moment, because it's essential to understanding what the economic potential is or isn't of crypto. And we're going to do that with Patrick McHenry, Chairman of the House Financial Services Committee. I'm Major Garrett. Stay with us.
We all have busy lives these days, and we don't want to waste a day recovering after a night out. That's why ZBiotics is the answer we've all been looking for. Their probiotic was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It's this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for your rough next day. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. This is a proactive solution that wards off feeling miserable the next day instead of a reactive approach like drinking electrolytes or eating greasy food. Enhance your mornings with ZBiotics. Go to ZBiotics.com/CBS to get 15% off your first order when you use code CBS at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember to head to ZBiotics.com/CBS and use the code CBS at checkout for 15% off. Thank you, ZBiotics, for sponsoring this episode and our good times.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
From CBS News, this is The Takeout with Major Garrett.
We're at Ted's Bulletin. Ted Tarts are, I'm here to tell you, spectacular, and caffeine and sugar make the world go round. Patrick McHenry is our guest, continuing our conversation. So, Mr. Chairman, on cryptocurrency, it arose, not directly, but somewhat indirectly, out of the Great Recession, and the sense that in the real estate collapse, there was inadequate measurement and registration of transactions, and things got bundled and do instruments that people could invest in, and blockchain is a way to systematically and via computers, as I understand it, verify each and every step of the transaction chain. The blockchain, that's where it gets each of those as a block, and it's on a chain, and it's therefore seamlessly and permanently verifiable, which all sounds great in theory. And is, in times of economic uncertainty, can be a place of reliability. And yet those are not the words that are being used in and around crypto right now, reliability and security. What went wrong?
It's third-party intermediaries that are encroaching on this space.
When you say a third-party intermediary, what does that mean?
people that are investing and speculating.
Okay.
And the key thing here is when you have a technology that's enabled by itself, you don't have to trust a third party to verify
the
contents of what's in there.
Right.
As you aptly described, it's in the technology.
Right.
Right? So I want to...
You don't need a bank to house that.
Right. It's housed within
the server,
technology.
Right. Right?
So, and the verification is owned by everybody that's a part of that chain. So understand this. In order to hack Bitcoin, you have to hack hundreds of thousands of different computers in order to potentially do that. So that safety is built into that system. What has become the fundamental challenge here are those that are using that technology or that are your on-ramps and off-ramps to that technology. They hold your asset, and if you get lending with them, are they truly a bank or not a bank?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And if they're not a bank, are they adhering to bank standards on that product? They're not adhering to those basic banking standards, number one. Number two, they're not holding your asset as your asset. Once it comes onto their books, it's a part of their books. And you have folks that are giving you a yield product, a return, that looks like the only way it would function is a Ponzi scheme to get that type of return in a market like this. And so what happened was fraudsters pretending to be other financial intermediaries mm-hmm. or trying to act like other financial intermediaries are using a good product and trying to enrich themselves in that wrap.
Right.
So that is where all the fraud has occurred.
Right.
Here.
And as valuations went up, people said, I got to get in. And they weren't. And they didn't have the ability to judge with whom they were getting in. And so they handed their money over to, in your word, fraudsters.
And that is...
And they got stung in the process.
And so those things are not blockchain-enabled or crypto-enabled frauds. They're old-school frauds.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing that they were doing in the 1880s in the stock market in the United States. They were doing in the crypto stock exchange, if you will, mm-hmm. Of the last decade. It's the same crap from the 1870s and 1880s in the U.S. stock market that they housed in a new product in the last decade. Mm-hmm. It's the stuff that we've rent out of our economic system through basic transparency and a basic set of property rights and law. We've got to provide those and provide clarity in this new marketplace.
As a practical matter, should anyone on your committee, Republican or Democrat, accept campaign contributions from this industry while writing this legislation?
It is their decision under their view.
Do you have a particular point of view on that?
Everyone is interested in my committee in some way, shape, or form.
Right.
And the people that contribute to my campaign are making a decision for themselves. I'm not making a decision to endorse their ideas. They're making a decision to endorse my ideas. Mm-hmm. That's been my longstanding view.
Right.
Members need to make a decision for themselves, and candidates need to make a decision for themselves on who they take contributions
Can
from.
Can you understand why the public, considering the history that you agreed with me, as I described earlier, lots of money being sloshed around to have nothing happen, might appreciate a higher wall of separation as this legislation moves forward?
Look, we're all worms in the political process. That's how the budget view that's how the public views us. I can tell you this. I have longstanding views that I've made very clear to the public, both when I was a candidate and all the way through my public life, and people need to hold me accountable for those views. And I can be held accountable just like everyone else every 2 years at the ballot box.
And a campaign contribution one way or the other is not going to tilt that?
No, you cannot buy my opinion one way or another. And if that were the case, I should go to jail. And those that do that should go to jail.
Understood. Do you have any aspirations, Patrick McHenry, to be Speaker of the House of Representatives?
No.
Never.
It's not my goal. It's my goal to be a successful chairman and to help Kevin McCarthy be a successful Speaker of the House. That's why I worked so hard to get Kevin elected, and I'm very happy that he's in the speakership. He is the right person for the job.
How difficult was that process?
Hard. It was one of the...
What made it hard?
A tight house. I mean, look, when you have a four-vote margin, and you had five people publicly saying they would never vote for Kevin McCarthy, we knew it was a tough task. It was my goal to get this number down to a single-digit array of people that were not going to vote for Kevin. If we could get that, if we could move people of the 20, and we could get it down to six, seven, eight people, I know of Kevin's personal capacity, one-on-one with people, and that could close it out. And that's exactly what happened. A whole group of us helped to go work that process. Folks that were part of the dissident group that were of goodwill and said, we want the right assurances and we can come on board. And so there was goodwill here. And 14 people moved during one vote. And that was the moment I knew it took Kevin's first world class ability one-on-one to close people that was going to get us across the line. So once I knew we got in that final afternoon, it was up to Kevin, and he closed it. And it was
one more hiccup.
Well, there was not just one more, but that was the one visible hiccup you could see on the House floor.
What else happened?
There was a lot more that happened that last day. On that last day, there are three times in my view that Kevin McCarthy was at that moment I thought would never be Speaker of the House. When I moved to adjourn the House because of Matt Gaetz's request that we adjourn the House, that was the third time. And I thought it was over.
So it was even more of a cliffhanger than it looked like on live television.
Yes.
That's the voice of Patrick McHenry, Chairman of the House Financial Services Committee. For our radio audience, we need to say farewell. Podcasters, please stay with us and on CBS News streaming. We'll be back next week. I'm Major Garrett. This has been The Takeout.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer.
So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
On the Nintendo Switch system, you can team up with friends in Super Mario Bros. Wonder,
where you can meet talking flowers.
Life's full of surprises.
And where piranha plants sing.
And where Mario, Luigi, and Peach turn into elephants.
Wowie zowie!
And where this announcer turns into a...
super tiny announcer!
That's not in the game.
Sorry, got a little excited. Nintendo Switch, the home of Mario and friends. Game rated E for everyone. Game and systems sold separately.
From CBS News, this is The Takeout with Major Garrett.
Welcome to your Takeout Outtake Especial. I'm Major Garrett. Ted's Bulletin, our host restaurant. Ted Tarts arrayed in front of us, sugar and caffeine. I said it before, I will say it again. Make the world go round. Patrick McHenry, chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, is our special guest. To continue the conversation we had that just ended in the main body of the show, three times you thought Kevin McCarthy, who is speaker now, might not be speaker. That is astonishing to me. Three times in that one
last,
Friday.
That was the last day.
Yeah.
Three times in the last
was
day.
Was that about a misunderstanding or dishonesty?
It's hard to tell. I'm too close to the situation. I want to believe largely about a misunderstanding on two of those occasions. Earlier in the day.
People thought they heard one thing and they heard another, or
yes,
it got lost in translation, yes, someone played telephone or whatever.
Yes, and that happens.
Sounds a little too neat to me.
Look, I mean, tensions were really high and emotions were very high. And there was a key moment early in the day where everything was going swimmingly on the House floor and visibly very positive.
Kevin McCarthy looked very confident. Others around him, yourself included, looked confident. It felt to those of us who were longtime observers of this, which we had never seen before, I grant you, so I was cautious, but it felt like the momentum was building and about to crest.
Well, that was at midday. And at midday, that was the first time I thought it was over. When I had a key member tell me that they would not move. And it was my responsibility to move this member to the S column. And
the member's name?
It's too soon still.
Too soon.
It's too soon still. Because emotions are still high.
Still raw.
And that was the moment I walked away from the conversation, and I thought it was over. And I thought it was over because of what I did. Now, I don't know if it's a misunderstanding. He said it wasn't me. I have no recollection of it being me. And that moment, everything was going well on the House floor. Everybody was very happy, and it was a visible show of progress for Kevin on the House floor. First time. The third time, I'll skip over the second time because it's such a jumbled mess that you don't have enough time.
Right.
The third time was when I was giving my nominating speech.
Right.
I knew we didn't have the votes. I knew that Boebert and Gates were not yeses, and I knew I was giving what I thought at 5 o'clock when Kevin asked me to do it, to give his final nominating speech, I thought was the final nominating speech. And by 6 o'clock, I knew it was not going to be the final nominating speech, that we're in store for a much longer road. So when I gave that speech at 10 o'clock... I was at absolute misery that we still had many, many potentially days to go. So very hard to put a good face on what I knew was a tough, tough situation.
It was my perspective, Mr. Chairman, watching it play out, that if it hadn't happened that night, it wasn't going to happen. That if it had been delayed until Monday, it would have all unraveled.
And I knew at
that
moment...
Would you agree with that?
I think it's a fair assessment. And that's why I knew... when Gates and Boebert didn't switch that night, that was the third moment I thought it was over. And when Gates said, we have to adjourn until Monday at noon, and I had a member who was in solidly in our column tell me we had to do that because of the violent situation that broke out, I knew we had a problem. And when I moved to adjourn that day, That was the absolute worst feeling I had during the whole battle for the speakership. From the moment after, the day after the election until the 15th vote. That is the absolute depths of my feeling. And it's, as a friend, the worst feeling I've had about what I've done to a friend. Because I thought at that moment that I'd basically killed my friend's chances to be Speaker of the House. So to go from that to 15 minutes later, it being worked out, was a hell of a feeling. And the biggest roller coaster I've had on the House floor in the shortest amount of time.
The voice of Patrick McHenry. Mr. Chairman, we usually ask the three threshold questions. I'm going to invite you back to this show when we get closer to the debt ceiling, and maybe when you have legislation on crypto, will you come back?
I'd love to.
And we'll do those questions then. But I wanted to hear you out on the drama, and I'm glad I did. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Major.
We'll see everyone. Come back next week.
The Takeout is produced by Arden Fari, Jamie Benson, Sarah Cook, Ellie Watson, Jake Rosen, and Ashley Armstrong. CBSN production by Eric Susanen. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Takeout Podcast. That's at Takeout Podcast. And for more, go to takeoutpodcast.com. The Takeout is a production of CBS News.
If you like The Takeout, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Stephen Colbert here to tell you about the Late Show Pod Show, which is our podcast. I'm here with my producer, Becca. Becca, what can people expect on the podcast?
The extended moments, for sure.
Where can people get that?
On the Late Show Pod Show with Stephen Colbert, wherever you get your podcasts.
I use the internet.
Who would want to kill their mother and their little sister? Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, early and ad-free on Wondery Plus, starting May 1st.